Sometimes you might feel trapped between the right and the left. No one listens when you say taxation is theft.
But there's a place where people know harsh government brings tears. So grab some blue and adrenochrome. Let's make the timeline weird. Friends against government. Friends against government.
They're your
friends.
So today we've got Colin from the Cato Institute on to talk about the Jones Act, and probably most of our listeners might be familiar with a different Jones Act, the Jim Jones Act that I co-signed in Congress that was offering subsidies for one-way boat rides to Guyana. That was several decades ago.
It was a good one.
You may or may not remember that, but this is actually a different one, I think, right, that you're coming on to talk about, Colin. Do you want to give us a little bit of an overview?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. First of all, thanks for having me on the program. So, the Jones Act is Section 27 of the Merchant Marine Act of 1920. And what it says is that any vessel transporting goods between two points within the U.S. has to meet four conditions. These conditions are that the vessel has to be U.S. flagged and registered. It has to be built in the United States. It has to be at least 75% U.S. crewed. And the ship or vessel has to be at least 75% U.S. owned.
Oh, okay. Okay. I was thinking 75% U.S. crude, as in like crude oil. I was like, how would they even measure how that was done? So this is, and we were talking a little bit before we started recording, but the first time I think that I saw this resurface, and I guess it's no coincidence, being in libertarian circles, it sounds like this is when Cato really kicked things off, was in response to, the hurricane that hit Puerto Rico, really devastated it. And, I remember Peter Schiff talking about it at that time, because I think he had just moved down there, and how it had affected the relief effort and the cost of goods and services that were downstream of shipping to the port. So when we were talking, you said that Cato launched a little project on this, probably in more or less direct response to that. But do you want to give some details and a little bit of background? Feel free to repeat what we were talking about before him.
Sure. So, like you said, in 2018, Cato kicked off what we call the Jones Act Reform Project. Basically, we said, this is a law that doesn't get enough attention, that really burdens the economy. It has a lot of effects that go unseen. I think a lot of people don't really appreciate the law or even aware of its existence. In fact, I think last year or the year before, there was an episode of Jeopardy, and the category was Puerto Rico, and the $500 question, the answer was the Jones Act, and nobody knew. None of these Jeopardy contestants knew. So, the first step, if you want to promote reform, is you need to build awareness of what this law is and what it does. So we've had that going for a while. And like I said, so you mentioned Puerto Rico, and Puerto Rico is a classic example of what this law does. So any ship going between Puerto Rico and the United States carrying goods back and forth. So basically any ship that wants to do business with, the world's largest economy has to meet these four conditions. And that's a real problem because, just look at these conditions one by one. First of all, the ship has to be U.S. flagged. Well, how many, there are something in the neighborhood of 40,000 ships in the world. Well, how many have a U.S. flag? 185 as of last month. The amount of competition, amount of choice is dramatically reduced. And then the next thing is, it has to be U.S. built. And that's a real problem because a U.S. built ship is anywhere from 4 to 5 times more expensive than one built in another country. So, instead of paying $50 million for a ship, you're paying $250 million for a ship. And consumers eat that cost. And so we have Puerto Rico, for example, they're dependent on maritime transport. And anything they buy and sell from the U.S. is going to be subject to these higher transportation costs. And furthermore, you know, this gets passed along to consumers because there isn't a lot of competition within the Jones Act market. So the number of carriers that serve Puerto Rico, I mean, on the surface, there are four, but two of those carriers have 85% of the container capacity. So basically, you have a duopoly down there. You know, you got Coke and Pepsi to choose from. So those guys can pass along the cost of those expensive ships to the consumers. In fact, a few years ago, I think maybe a decade ago or so, there was a case in which I believe five or six shipping executives were convicted of price fixing down in Puerto Rico because they were able to coordinate the rates that they set for shipping and were able to jack those up. And that would be impossible without the Jones Act, because without the Jones Act, you could take a foreign flagship and to buy and send goods to and from the mainland United States. But the Jones Act guarantees that you don't have to worry about any of that foreign competition. So you can get a handful of corporate executives in a room and they can all coordinate to raise prices. And you just find this all over the United States. We have very limited competition. We have a very limited number of ships. The number of U.S. built ships out there, they're U.S. flagged, 99 ships, 56 or 57 of those are oil tankers. So there's not a lot of ships to choose from. There's not a lot of competition. And we all pay the price through higher transportation costs.
I feel like that's like the ultimate white collar like street cred accumulation. That's like when rappers go to jail on a weapons charge. You know, you got to be involved in some sort of price fixing, and it should probably be in the Caribbean somewhere. That seems right, Bird.
Yeah, I'm having trouble with the figure of there's only 100 and what did you say 80 ships that are U.S.
185 U.S. flagships.
That's unbelievable.
The world, and out of those, you know, there's only 99 that are U.S. built. So there's only 99 that qualify under the Jones Act that you can use to send transport goods domestically.
So there are
go ahead.
There are only 100 and some odd ships that bring goods from foreign countries into this country. Am I understanding that correct? Through U.S. ports.
Fortunately, you know, the Jones Act only applies domestically. If I want to buy something from a foreign country, I can use a foreign flag ship.
Okay.
And those are much cheaper.
Right.
And that's, you know, foreign flag ships transport something like, I think 98.5% of everything that comes into this country is on a foreign flag ship.
Sure.
And those, I think, 86 ships that are U.S. flagged but not U.S. built, so they operate in foreign trades, a lot of those get various subsidies from the U.S. government to keep those in business, because
against
the foreign flagships. So yeah, that's how that works.
So following that, then I guess the next question is, an administration, especially like the one that we have, Donald Trump's administration has, I don't know, the line has been lower domestically, lower the prices as much as we can, get corporations in the U.S. working again. It seems to me that, I mean, this is a protectionist. Obviously, the Jones Act is very protectionist, but it seems like it makes U.S. goods more expensive. So I don't, why 100%. Would they have
yeah,
not?
Yeah, that's a great point. In fact, so the Jones Act is always billed and sold by the Jones Act lobby as being this very pro U.S. law, because, you know, it forces people to use U.S. built U.S. crewed ships. But the reality, I think, is very different, because anything that goes has to be transported domestically, has to go on one of these ships. In turn, it makes anything transported in those ships much more expensive than would otherwise be the case.
Right.
So, for example, in Puerto Rico, the GAO did a study in 2013 about the Jones Act's effects. They talked to people in the agricultural community down there, and they said, you know, when we go to buy, say, fertilizer or animal feed, we usually just buy it from another country, because if we buy it from the United States, which is the agricultural powerhouse, we got to pay that extra cost of Jones Act transport. If we buy it from another country, don't have to worry about Jones Act transport. It's a lot cheaper.
Right.
So that's lost sales. And with Puerto Rico, it's even more frustrating, because not only is it more expensive to buy American products, but sometimes it can actually be impossible to buy American products. For example, Puerto Rico uses natural gas for about one third of its power generation. So they need natural gas. And the United States has a lot of natural gas. Puerto Rico can't buy any of it because there are no LNG carriers, liquefied natural gas carriers, in the Jones Act fleet. Of those 99 ships, none of them are capable of transporting bulk quantities of natural gas. So
Puerto Rico has to buy
100% of it from other countries. In fact, last, I think, October, they took a shipment of natural gas that originated in Russia. So we're buying Russian natural gas because they literally cannot buy American natural gas because there are no ships to transport it.
The ships just flat out don't have the equipment to transport it. Is that what you're saying?
There's a specialized type of vessel called an LNG carrier, specially built just for transporting natural gas, and they're zero in the Jones Act fleet. And a lot of people, I think the logical next question is, okay, we'll just go build the ship and then problem solved. Well, it's not that simple. First off, no U.S. shipyard has built that kind of ship since the 1970s. Jeez. So we're not even sure they know how to build it. In fact, there was a government report that came out a few years ago that said that basically to build one in the United States, we'd have to bring over like 250 or 300 South Koreans to teach Americans how to do it. And even if they knew how to do it, the Wall Street Journal reported last year to buy one of those ships in Asia, it costs about $180 million. To build one here in the United States, about $700 million. Jeez. So we're talking literally $500 million more for just one ship. I mean, there's no economic case for that. No one in their right mind is ever going to build that. So it doesn't get built. And so Americans can't buy American products because of this law.
Yeah, that's crazy. So and would you say that the primary primary kind of victims of this are these like American territories that are not part of mainland US?
I would say that the non-contiguous states and territories, Alaska, Hawaii,
Puerto Rico,
those are the most obvious victims of the Jones Act because, of course, they're dependent on waterborne.
This is why everything in Hawaii
they can't
is
use a truck or rail. They have no alternatives. But I think that, in fact, you know, we all get hit pretty hard by this law. And the reason we don't see it is because we can't see that alternative universe that would exist. We don't see the options that would otherwise exist if not for this law. Mm. Because our maritime sector shrunk so much, it's not an option for people. For example, you know, on the East Coast, we have trucks that go up and down I-95. There is zero Jones Act container shipping that goes up and down the East Coast. If you want to send something on a container from Boston to Miami, not going to happen because the ships don't exist. So, you know, there's no before and after for us to see. It's like, you know, no Jones Act and then Jones Act. That way we could really see the costs. But, you know, over time, the number of ships atrophied and shrunk. So we just don't notice anymore because for all intents and purposes, especially as far as coastal shipping, we don't have much of a maritime sector. So you can't miss something you don't have.
Right. Yeah, it's such a weird law. Like it's you know, there are so many things that are on the horizon for libertarians to kind of complain about, but this one is so niche and so seemingly archaic. Like it's just like a very bizarre thing. But like you said, it has a lot of unintended consequences. And then to your point, you know, every economic transaction has two sides. So while Puerto Rico may not be able to import natural gas, that also means that Houston can't export it. So that, you know, to Puerto Rico anyway. It's a real bummer. What is your estimation of how entrenched is the, for lack of any specific words, the Jones Act lobby? Like how much is this dug in?
It's absolutely dug in. John McCain, he was a champion of Jones Act reform when he was in the Senate, and he said it was the most powerful lobby he ever came up against.
Really?
Yeah. And I think a large part of the reason is we've got a lot of status quo bias.
Yeah.
The U.S. has had cabotage laws like the Jones Act founding of the Republic.
Yep.
Right.
So
yep.
It's kind of like, this is the way it's always been. This is the way we've always done things. And, you know, why change? And then there are all these people that benefit from the status quo. I mean, think about it. If you're a U.S. shipyard, this is a home run for you. I mean, it's basically saying you have to buy what we build. You know, that's so great for them. So they are up on Capitol Hill all the time making the case, saying you got to keep this law. And so, the benefits are very concentrated and the costs are dispersed among all of us. And like I said, I mean, a lot of Americans don't even know the law exists. So, one time I talked to someone who works up on Capitol Hill and they said to me, you know, you're the first person I've ever talked to that kind of gave me the other side of this issue. They only hear from one side. So there's not a lot of incentive, unfortunately, on Capitol Hill to pursue reform because they know absolutely – who they're going to anger. They're going to anger organized labor. They're going to anger the shipyards. And, you know, who's going to be very upset with them? And it's not obvious, you know, who's going to shake their hand, who's going to slap them on the back and say, you know, job well done. A lot of people see a lot of downside to pursuing Jones Act reform and not a lot of upside, unfortunately.
How many, if you could take a guess, or maybe there's a known number, how many companies operate that merchant fleet? Like how many actually?
So in the United States, domestically, you know, not counting like people operating barges and small little vessels like that, you just want to talk about those 99 ships.
Yeah, in the Jones Act
among,
fleet.
Among container shipping, so, you know, Puerto Rico, like I said, they're served by two companies, which is Crowley and Tote Maritime. Hawaii is served by Matson and Pasha Hawaii, and then Alaska is served by Matson and Tote. So, you know,
six companies,
I said the same name several times. I mean, there's just a handful of companies out there,
God.
Really, that count for, you know, the majority of these ships. And then you have other companies that operate those tankers. But among, you know, people that put stuff on a container, send it within the United States, there's only a handful of companies, you know, if that. That operate in the Jones Act fleet.
Mm. Those are the companies behind the lobby.
Oh,
a very few.
Yeah, I mean, yes. You know, there's a group called the American Maritime Partnership. These guys are all members of them. they are, you know, like I said, lobbying all the time for this law. There's the Shipbuilders Council of America. There's the Inland Waterways Operator, the American Waterways Operators. There's all kinds of maritime unions representing labor. You know, the AFL-CIO supports the Jones Act.
Mm.
So you have all these very concentrated beneficiaries. And again, they are on Capitol Hill all the time telling legislators to get in line.
Why would a national union support the Jones Act, which only benefits a very small number of workers?
Yeah, and here's the other thing. You know, I hesitate when I say the word, you know, concentrated beneficiaries and people that benefit from this law, because in the long term, these guys have all lost from this law. You know, I mentioned there are 99 ships. Back in the 1950s, there were like 434 ships, I believe.
Uh-huh.
You know, you go back to the year 2000, there were 193 ships. So we keep seeing, you know, fewer ships, fewer mariners. It keeps shrinking. This law is not working out for anybody. The number of shipyards has gone down. You know, there's only four shipyards in the United States that build these large ocean-going ships. One of them, the Philly Shipyard, which has built 50% of about half of all Jones Act ships since the year 2000, they currently have nothing on their order book. They've laid off most of their workforce. The only thing they're doing right now is they're doing repairs on two government vessels. But, you know, and it's no surprise, who wants to buy a $250 million ship? Mm. It's insane.
Yeah. Right.
So, you know, fewer ships, fewer mariners. It's not working for American consumers, but it's not even working for the maritime industry itself.
Yeah, it seems, you know, like they're getting into a classic, like, this whenever you socialize things or trend towards that arrangement where the only solution is to, you know, raise prices to try to raise money, but then you just regulate yourself out of contention.
Yeah,
against
I
all
think
economic.
It's instructive that, you know, the only places you really find Jones Act ships, it's two things. They're either transporting oil, you know, those 57 tankers, or they're going to Alaska, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, Guam, where they have no other choice.
Mm-hmm.
Because if anybody has a choice, why on earth would you want to put it on a Jones Act ship, given how, you know, even if you could find a ship, how insanely expensive they are? So we've managed to take, you know, waterborne transport, which is typically one of the cheapest, you know, most efficient ways of moving, you know, something from point A to point B, and we've made it thoroughly uncompetitive. It's crazy.
Yeah, that's wild. We had talked about how this was some form of these laws have been in existence since the founding of the country. But what was behind, I assume that there was some fallout from World War I that caused this, act to come into actual formation. Can you give us a little bit of history on like what was going on at that time?
Yeah, so the backstory is this. Like I said, U.S. has had cabotage laws since the get-go, basically. But I would point out a couple things. Number one, it was more understandable back then because you could, if you had, if you guaranteed yourself a fleet of merchant vessels, they had a lot of utility in times of war, because you could just put some cannon on them and basically turn them into privateers that could then function as, you know, de facto part of the Navy. And also back at that time when the country was first started, U.S. was, we were some of the best shipbuilders in the world. I mean, U.S. The quality was on par with anything the Europeans were churning out, and the prices were typically like, you know, 30 to 50% cheaper. So it was really not a big imposition, because they said, hey, you have to use, you know, the world's most efficient shipbuilders. That, you know, that's not a big price to pay. But as time went on, this protected sector became more and more uncompetitive. And then, so you have, again, like you mentioned, World War One. After World War One, the U.S. built, the government built a lot of ships, and they need to figure out, what do we do with all these ships that we built? And so they had these hearings and they had studies. What do we do? And there was this bill called the Merchant Marine Act of 1920. And it, you know, most of it was things like seamen's rights and what, you know, disposing of those U.S. Government-owned vessels. But then we had something called, you know, Section 27, which is the Jones Act. So you have to wonder, what was the point of the Jones Act if we already had cabotage laws in the books? And the reason we have the Jones Act is because back at this time, you were able to transport, if you were able to transport something over land, then it was exempt from cabotage law. For example, you could take something, send it by rail from the United States up to Vancouver, and send it from Vancouver on a foreign flagship to Alaska. Well, shipping companies in Seattle did not like this, because they had to compete with foreigners for serving that Alaska market. Well, guess who represented Seattle? Senator Wesley Jones of Washington State, the author of the Jones Act. The whole point of the Jones Act was to get these Canadian shipping companies out of the Alaska market and basically turn business over to the duopoly in Seattle, which was the Alaska Shipping Company and the Pacific Shipping Company. And one of the guys from the Pacific Shipping Company testified before Senator Jones's committee and said, hey, you know, he said, basically, we've got all this competition we don't really like. We'd really appreciate if you change the laws to make it illegal to send things over land up to Vancouver and then use a foreign flag ship. And he said, here's the language we'd like to see implemented. If you look at the Jones Act today, it very much reflects what that member of the Pacific Steamship Company proposed. So this is basically, you know, crony capitalists at its core. And remember, back then, Alaska was a territory, not a state. They didn't get a say in this whole thing. They didn't get a vote on it. So the true origin of the Jones Act itself was basically to reward shipping interests in Seattle and harm Alaskan consumers.
My gut reaction is still to just blame Canada for this. I'm not sure.
I was very close to doing the same thing.
Yeah, feels like feels like that's in order.
I just can't believe that. I was researching this before, and I think it was at some point after the hurricane, in Puerto Rico, because of the Jones Act, like, prices on consumers were raised on the year by like $400 a year, some crazy number per year, just because of these shipping concerns.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of debate out there. You know, what is the cost to Puerto Rico? It's really hard to nail down, because, you know, if you look at the price of goods, I mean, there's any number of factors that determine what the price of something is, you know, taxes, regulations, the cost of real estate, et cetera, et cetera. But certainly transportation is one of those. And I think we can have a good debate over exactly what the cost is to Puerto Rico, but there is no debate that there is a cost to Puerto Rico. And what's absolutely insane is that, you know, a few months after the hurricane, after the spotlight had been shown on Puerto Rico, and there was talk about the Jones Act, the American Maritime Partnership, that group I mentioned earlier that is composed of, you know, all these shipping companies, they were feeling the heat. So they put together a report, a term I kind of use loosely, that said, oh, there is no cost to consumers in Puerto Rico from the Jones Act. And the way they figured this is they went to Walmart's website. They pulled out 13 items, and they said, hey, for these 13 items, it costs the same in their San Juan store than it does in Jacksonville, Florida, where these ships come from. But it's, you know, this is garbage. There have been a few economists that have tried to, you know, nail this down, And the estimates you find are anywhere from the hundreds of millions of dollars to a little over $1 billion. It depends how you calculate these things. I mean, you know, I mentioned earlier about the inability to buy U.S. LNG. Well, the head of the Puerto Rico Electrical Power Authority testified before Congress last year. He said, hey, that's costing us hundreds of millions of dollars in higher prices for the natural gas we buy because we can't buy U.S. LNG, which is some of the cheapest LNG around. And ultimately for me, I mean, we can talk about numbers, but it really shouldn't matter. The only number that should matter is the fact that Puerto Rico has a 43% poverty rate, and yet we're subjecting them to some of the highest shipping rates in the world. I think it's absolutely unconscionable. We have this whole debate here in Washington of, you know, how do we go about helping Puerto Rico, and everyone has different ideas, and a lot of them center around, you know, different government handouts. Before we do anything, why don't we just stop hurting Puerto Rico? Why don't we stop you know, forcing them to be under the Jones Act and stop making them pay out the nose for everything that gets shipped from here to there? To give you a perspective on shipping rates, in 2012, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York put out a report that mentioned the Jones Act, and it said that to ship a container from the East Coast of the United States to Puerto Rico cost about a little over $3,000. To send that same container to Jamaica or the Dominican Republic, you know, roughly the same distance, same size kind of markets, were about half that, around $1,500. So, you know, you're doubling transportation costs, you know, according to the U.S. government.
Yeah.
And what about, you said Hawaii was also affected by this. What about, I know Hawaii has a really high unemployment rate. Do you think that's part of this, that they can't get as many supplies in? Like, what other kind of effects in other states are we seeing?
Yeah, so you know, in Hawaii, I mean, it's going to be the same thing. You know, they're paying more for what they buy. Certainly, it factors into the cost of living there. You know, how much? I think, again, we can have a good debate about what that is. But, you know, one crazy thing to me about Hawaii is that we know there's some cost. And whenever the Jones Act gets brought up, a lot of Jones Act lobby people, they'll say, hey, well, there's no hard numbers. We don't really know. That's all theoretical. And this could be fairly easily resolved if, say, a member of Congress asked the GAO to do a study on this, or commission some kind of government study so we could get those numbers. But both the senators from Hawaii are Jones Act supporters.
Now, how is that possible?
Asked for a report, so we can't even get the numbers. But we know beyond just Econ 101 theory, we have some examples that are kind of telling. You know, I mentioned that Puerto Rico can't buy LNG. Well, you know, LNG carriers, that's just one type of ship that's not in the Jones Act fleet. But there are lots of different types of ships that don't exist. The United States is the world's leading exporter of liquefied petroleum gas. So basically, you know, propane, butane. And yet Hawaii has to buy it from as far away as Africa because there are no ships to transport it. They cannot buy it from the United States. And I mean, I think our intuition all tells us that, you know, it's far cheaper to buy from the U.S. mainland than to buy from Africa. And I think the story just repeats itself over and over again. And again, we have Hawaii. There's a duopoly serving there. You know, you got Pasha, you got Matson. That's all you have to choose from. So it's not a question of does this cost Hawaii. It's only a matter of how much. And unfortunately, we don't have the numbers, and the government hasn't done a study to really, you know, put an exact number on that.
How are both of the senators supporters of the Jones Act?
It's crazy. It's totally counterintuitive. Everyone assumes that the reason that we have the Jones Act is because Hawaii and Alaska show up in the Senate and they say, we need to do something about this. And everyone says, yeah, well, you're just two states. Nobody cares, whatever. And the reality is that the states that are most harmed by the Jones Act are also the biggest supporters of the Jones Act. And that reason is because they're also disproportionately home to interest groups that profit from the Jones Act. You better believe that Matson is very much trying to tell you know, the legislators in Hawaii what a great law this is, that it's documented that they, you know, donate to their campaigns. And all the maritime unions are doing the same. So one of the odd things is that when it comes to talking about Jones Act reform, it's often people from the landlocked states that are pushing it, like John McCain of Arizona. He didn't have to worry about any maritime unions or other maritime industry groups breathing down his neck there in Arizona. Last year, you had a Jones Act repeal bill introduced by Senator Mike Lee of Utah. Last year, Senator Trump, or President Trump, was considering the issuing a waiver for the Jones Act so that people could transport LNG using foreign flag ships. They could, solve that issue I mentioned earlier about Puerto Rico not being able to buy U.S. natural gas. And the next week, six senators went down to the White House telling you better not do this, including both of Alaska senators. It's absolute madness.
And I wonder too, is like, and I'm not super familiar with kind of the tradition behind grandfathering various things and waiving various things within the federal government, but I'd be worried, you know, I'd be, if I were looking to import LNG and I saw a waiver, I'd certainly have concerns of how long is this going to last? Am I going to go through all of this time and effort and spend all of this money to go to establish new, shipping partners? And then, you know, next year in a political, in an election season, it maybe, you know, something changes. And it's like that could be devastating.
Yeah. I mean, there's a real lack of certainty around these things. And yeah, such a waiver would only be as good as, you know, say President Trump is in office and the next guy comes along and then no more waiver. And then again, like you said, you have to rejigger your supplies and your suppliers and start from scratch.
Tremendously expensive. Yeah, that's really unfortunate. What is the history of repeal attempts or any sort of defensive measures taken at the federal level against the Jones Act? I mean, like, you guys said that you just commissioned something from, you know, in 2018. I'm sure that there was discussion before that, you know, on some level, just as there would naturally be within libertarian circles, but or at least, you know, even probably, well, libertarian for sure, and I'm sure there are other interest groups that lobby against it as well. But what is that history? Why has it ever come close? Has it to being repealed, or is this thing just absolutely? It's basically hiding in plain sight, and that's why it's so tough to fight.
So I think the last real concentrated attempt to secure some kind of Jones Act, either repeal or reform, was back in the 1990s. There was something called the Jones Act Reform Coalition that was headed by a guy named Rob Cortell, who was a former federal maritime commissioner. And, you know, I think when he was on the on the Federal Maritime Commission, he had his eyes really opened to just all the government regulation out there, the maritime sector, and not only the regulation, but just the absolute failure of U.S. policy. And, you know, I think we'd have an interesting discussion here if, on the one hand, you know, we all paid extra costs because of Jones Act, but on the other hand, we have this vibrant shipbuilding sector and lots of ships and all the rest. But, you know, we're paying it extra, and it's hurting our economy in exchange for what? In exchange for nothing. Anyway, Cortell led the Jones Act Reform Coalition. This coincided with the advent of the Republican Congress back in the mid-90s. They made some headway. There were a number of hearings held in which Jones Act dissidents were able to make their voice heard, which is a big contrast from today. Every time there's a Hill hearing, it's stacked front to back with Jones Act supporters. People like me never ever get a voice.
Is there any bills
introduced, like, but ultimately, you know, the effort kind of petered out, and the Jones Act lobby just proved superior.
That's really frustrating.
And like I said, I mean, and then, you know, like I said, just last year, there was this waiver just for LNG that appeared on President Trump's desk, which Trump ended up not moving on. And it's not, you know, the generous interpretation here is it's not hard to understand because he had six senators down the White House plus Steve Scalise saying, don't do this. And he had absolutely nobody, you know, making the counter argument saying, no, you should do this. We're going to benefit from it. It's a political loser. And I think that story plays itself out over and over. And it's particularly frustrating with LNG because it's such a bulletproof issue in the sense that literally nobody would have lost their job because of this waiver, because this is not a service that Jones Act lobby, the Jones Act carriers offer. No shipyards would have lost any business because we're not going to build any of those ships. And yet you still can't get something like that through. It's absolutely crazy.
Yeah, it feels like the amount of nuance and knowledge you need to have in order to understand the Jones Act and its effects is not huge, but just enough that it's like very, very difficult to, in a few, you know, in a few well-delivered lines, like bring, you know, let people understand what exactly this is. And so, you know, maybe it makes it a little bit of a difficult political topic. And not to mention, probably, though destructive though it is, it probably doesn't rank in terms of all the destructive things government's doing. You know, it maybe isn't, you know, in the top 5 or 10 or something like, or I don't know, maybe it is, maybe you have a different thought on that, but
yeah, you know. I think you're right. I do think that there is a bit of a lack of knowledge. I remember that last year there was a hearing on Capitol Hill in which a member of Congress asked the president of the Offshore Marine Service Association. He said something along the lines of, hey, you know, we've got all this natural gas, and I understand that Puerto Rico and New England, like, they can't get access to it. New England, you know, has limited pipeline infrastructure. So whenever there's a spike in demand, anything extra they want to bring in to accommodate that spike in demand has to be brought in by ship. In fact, I think in early 2018, Russian oil was also imported into New England. Because again, the ships don't exist. They can't buy U.S. LNG. Anyway, this member of Congress asked the president of OMSA, what are we going to do about that? Is there any prospect of that being solved? And the president of OMSA said, well, you know, we're working on that. We've got these LNG barges out there, and we're really coming up with solutions. And it was total nonsense. Those barges he mentioned, there are two barges. These are used for refueling ships. They're not used for transporting LNG from place to place. The capacity of these things is something like, 2% of that of what you'd find of a ship dedicated to transporting LNG. These things are not solutions, but, you know, the member of Congress just kind of nodded his head and thought, okay, you know, good answer. When in fact he was being fed a line of nonsense.
Jesus. What kind of support did Mike Lee's bill get?
He attracted, so far he's attracted no co-sponsors.
Oh my God.
Nice. So that should tell you something. Mike Lee also introduced one other bill. There was a pretty interesting one. It was called something like the, you know, Allow Americans to Buy American Products Act or something like this.
I think I vaguely remember that.
Phenomenon I described earlier about the inability to transport products because the ships don't exist. And it was basically, it would implement a waiver system saying, hey, if the ships don't exist, you should be allowed to use a foreign one, right? Because again, you know, no one's losing their job here. You're not displacing anybody because the ships don't exist. And I think he tried to introduce, he introduced a standalone bill, and he also tried to introduce it as, I think, an amendment to the Coast Guard Authorization Act. And it got shot down something like 22-4. There were a total of 4 people that voted for it.
Oh my God.
Which is really depressing. And again, especially so because this is such a common sense thing to do. If you have these instances where there's no ship available, why not be able to use a foreign ship? Because again, no one's losing out here. No one's being displaced. And yet something even that like commonsensical can't get done.
Do we get to attribute it to malice or?
Yeah, you have to wonder. I mean, I watched the hearing. And I remember one of the senators from Massachusetts was speaking about this, which is interesting because, of course, Massachusetts suffers because they, you know, have imported Russian natural gas. They can't get U.S. natural gas. And he said, well, you know, I think that these U.S. shipping companies, they should just do the right thing and take some of those ships that were built in the 1970s that can carry natural gas and just put them under the U.S. flag. And then, you know, we're good and put a U.S. crew. And that's how we should solve this whole thing. And I just thought to myself, this guy, he doesn't know what he's talking about because, A, you know, again, there's like 3 ships in the world that were built in the 1970s. They're still in existence and they all have been operating in Indonesia. And to put them back under the U.S. flag, they have to be U.S. owned, which they're not. And they were given a special waiver back in 2011. And no one took advantage of this because then you've got these old ships that are, you know, 40 years old. Ships are typically scrapped after about 20 years. And they would have to undergo, you know, a tremendous amount of upgrades and stuff to get certified by the Coast Guard to be used. And if nothing else, the solution is basically, hey, make do with 40-year-old ships. That, you know, this is America. You should make do with third best. So it's, I couldn't help but suspect that this particular senator was just absorbing Jones Act lobby talking points that had been given to him that he really didn't understand, because if he knew anything about the maritime sector and LNG, he would understand this was a total non-solution that he was putting forward. So, I think it's a combination of ignorance and
money.
I hate to go down the road of, you know, these guys are bought and paid for.
Sometimes it's the case.
Sometimes the arguments are so bad, you're not left with a whole lot of choices.
Yeah, yeah, it sometimes is the case.
I love the idea of running into somebody's office and shouting, "Don't you know anything about maritime law or liquid natural gas? Come on!"
And on the one hand, can you really blame them? I mean, these are fairly obscure topics. It's not something that everybody knows about. You really have to drill down to get an understanding here. And I think that really caters to the Jones Act lobby. They have a real asymmetric advantage. They provide these guys with the talking points, and these guys lack the knowledge to really push back on them. And fortunately, people from the reform side, there is currently no organized anti-Jones Act lobby. One does not exist, so these guys don't even hear from the other side.
Jeez. Why is maritime law so depressing? It should be fun. You're out on the ocean. You're delivering,
is painting a very different picture than
I was promised of boating. I was promised. Yeah, I read about this, and one of the topics was merchant navy, and I was like, oh, that sounds fun, and then I looked into it. It's not fun. It's a giant cartel. Would you actually, and on that, would you say that there's a, and it's not hugely important, it's just an ideological argument, but would you say that this kind of a law, it really violates, to me, the sense of property rights in this country? It may not literally violate them, but the idea that you have to, in order to do a job that a foreign worker could do without the restrictions, maybe different restrictions, but without the same restrictions, you have to go through a probably crazy process to buy a ship, register the ship. It has to be owned and operated by a U.S. citizen. You have to follow these very strict codes. And you have to deal with the cartel. This seems very much dug into state ownership. At the very least, a cartelized ownership like you were talking about.
I just think that, you know, one thing I think we all stand for as Americans, or typically a lot of people embrace, is the notion of competition. And competition is good. Competition is a virtue. Competition is something to be embraced. And this is a thoroughly uncompetitive, anti-competition law. These provisions, some of them are just inconsistent with other parts of U.S. law. For example, the U.S. build requirement. You know, we don't have a U.S. build requirement for airplanes. We don't have one for cars, for trucks, for rail, for anything else. I mean, you can move anything else and not have to comply with a domestic build requirement. And yet, if it goes by water, it has to be U.S. built. And what's I think really obvious here also is you can't help but notice those places where we have no U.S. build requirement, airplanes. Well, does that mean we don't build airplanes in this country? No, of course not. You know, Boeing is a world leader in building commercial airplanes. You know, Ford and GM are some of the largest automakers in the world. So this notion that you need domestic build requirements to have an industry, I think is thoroughly misplaced. If anything, it's probably the opposite, because our shipbuilding sector is just operating so poorly. So that's, you know, that's something that really strikes me. And then, the idea that as someone living in, for example, Hawaii, that has no choice really but to use ships, that I don't get a choice in that. That just really rubs me the wrong way. And this is, you know, leave aside the economics for a second. This is very much an anti-freedom law. It's like, here are all the things you can't do.
Yeah.
And I always think if the government is going to take away our freedom, it better have a really good reason for doing that. And I look here and I can't find one. I don't know what it is.
No. Mm-mm. No, it serves a few people. And you don't have to say it. I suspect there's perhaps a little bit of canoodling under the table going on. But you know, you know, you know, it's whatever well, it is. In, it's depressing.
It's like these. It's like the victims are
us.
asymmetrically poor, like Puerto Ricans and you know, or not necessarily poor individually, but lack resources as a collective. Like the population of Alaska just isn't that big. The population of Hawaii just isn't that big. Puerto Rico's poor and doesn't have a huge population. So like, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, speaking of Hawaii, something I didn't mention earlier, you asked about the economic costs there, you know, shipping is so expensive there. There have been documented examples of Hawaii is home to actually some of the largest cattle ranch herds in the country. They're in the top 25, I think. And so if they want to send their cattle back to the West Coast for processing or put them on feedlots, they have two choices. One, they can put them on a ship. Now, in most countries, the way you do that is you put it on what's called a livestock carrier. As the name suggests, these are ships specially designed to carry livestock. But there are, of course, there are none in the Jones Act fleet. So you can put on what they call a cowtainer. These are modified shipping containers. You know, they put a trough in there and some accommodation for the animals. No other country uses these things. They're totally ridiculous, but we use them because there are no livestock carriers. Or you can put them on an airplane and fly them to the West Coast using a backhaul because, you know, airplanes go to Hawaii fully loaded. They usually come back less than fully loaded. So there are Hawaiian cattle ranchers that will put some of their cattle on airplanes and fly them to the West Coast rather than put them on a ship because the costs are so similar. You know, it's absolutely bonkers. We talk about you know, the different ways that this law manifests itself. Well, right now, literally this week, The Washington Post had an article about Alaska's marine highway system. This is their ferry system, which, of course, for Alaska, a lot of coastline, not a lot of highway. It's going to be very important. Well, they're really struggling right now because they got a bunch of old ships. They like to replace them. And these old ships are very expensive to maintain. But if you're going to buy a ship, it has to be built in the U.S. because of the Jones Act. So these guys have to pay out the nose. And yet we have all this discussion about the Alaska Marine Highway System and how they're running out of money, and no one's talking about the Jones Act and the fact that it costs an arm and a leg to replace these vessels. Down in Vancouver, they have a ferry system as well. In British Columbia, they buy them all from Europe, you know, and they pay half the price than what the Alaskans are paying, and we don't even talk about it. It's absolutely maddening.
Jeez. That's crazy. I guess we should end on the last thing is, what can we do? What do we do about it? If a bill has no cosigns and it's just Mike Lee, which is hilarious, in one of the states with probably the least amount of water, is the only one who gets the bill to go out. What do we do? What can be done?
I think what can be done is like for most things, for most laws or get involved politically, it's contact your member of Congress. And, you know, speaking personally, I would, you know, urge them to support or at the very least, you know, have to urge them to support various bills. You know, as a working for the Cato Institute for 501c3, I don't endorse particular legislation. I can't advocate for it. But if nothing else, just ask your member of Congress, where do you stand on the Jones Act, and make them justify their support for it if they are a supporter, because I think it's a very hard law to justify, and you got to do a lot of logical leaps and jump through a lot of hoops to really make that argument. So at least get them on record. And again, traditionally, the Jones Act advocating for reform has been a political loser. There isn't a constituency for it. So try to show that, no, there is another side, and it's not just these handful of shipping companies that care about this issue, and there are a lot of people who like to see this law gone. Politicians are not going to care until they think that the people care.
Right.
They're not going to go out on a limb for nothing.
Do you recommend that you use aggressive language with your congressman?
I always recommend, you know, people try to be civil. You know, if you're too nasty, from what I've heard, your letter will probably just be immediately thrown in the trash and be disregarded. But yeah, just say, hey, where do you stand on the Jones Act? I mean, I think it's a bad law. You know, what are you doing about it?
Okay.
You
know, So you know, we'll say hey.
Get them on record.
Say hey and don't say hey fucko. Don't open hey, fucko. With that.
Hey fucko, Jones Act, let's talk.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's a shame because like I think everybody listening and Colin you and Carr you and I, we all know writing only goes so far. And writing and not having money enclosed in the envelope in the way that lobbying works makes it a lot harder for the grassroots movement to start to get some of these people to changing the laws. But what else? I mean, there really is nothing else. Unfortunately, there has to be a fundamental change.
Yeah, I think you know, also just writing, you know, hey, write an op-ed, write a letter to the editor. Just like a week or two ago, I saw a letter to the editor in a New Hampshire newspaper, and a guy was just railing about the Jones Act and saying this is a dumb law, we need to get rid of it. And it's not only your federal representatives. I know that I don't know the backstory here, but back in January, a bill was introduced in the West Virginia legislature that had like 7 co-sponsors, I believe, calling for Washington to repeal the Jones Act. And so even getting your state legislature to say, hey, D.C., this is something you need to do something about. You know, that's, I think there could be things done at the state level to get the attention of federal lawmakers. So, you know, also keep that in mind.
Sure, sure. Well, there you go. Carr, you got anything else? You want to maybe get some boating tips?
Yeah, sure. What do you got? What so theoretically, if you were to be dodging the Jones Act, how would you go about it? You know, we've got a couple of
That's our next interview, Carr. That's our next interview.
Particularly active listeners of our podcast.
Well, fortunately, like I said, 40,000 vessels out there, a whole lot to choose from, you know, without the Jones Act. So
that is crazy, huh? It's crazy how many more ships there are.
And the other crazy thing is that, again, these ships are in our ports.
So, of course.
You know, the choice is not, do we let foreigners in? No, the foreigners are already here.
Right.
The foreigners are here. They even go from port to port already. What they just can't do is pick something up in one port and drop it off in the other. But you'll get a ship that'll come over, say, from Rotterdam and drop some stuff off in New York and then go down to Florida and drop some more stuff off there or then pick something up in Florida to sure. take to another country. So they're already operating in our waters. It's basically, you know, like a... it's a system out there, you know, a transportation system that we just can't use. Well, it's just off limits to Americans, but it's sitting right there.
So
it's a law that's meant to be broken. Would you say that, Colin?
I'd say it's just crying out for reform.
It brings up a good topic. There's that many ships. I'm sure many of those ships in the sea that are not in covered under the Jones Act are owned by China or operated by Chinese citizens. My question would be, we just had a trade war. Quote, I say with the biggest air quotes, we just had a trade war that I believe has been suspended for the time being. Comparatively, how much did that affect the Chinese shippers as opposed to what the Jones Act does to the average American? Like, are we looking, is this a trade war being waged on other American citizens?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a great way of looking at it.
You know, I love it.
Americans are the victims here. You know, again, we can't even buy some American products because of this law. It's a thoroughly anti-American law. You know, even these U.S.-built ships, you know, you open up these ships, they're full of foreign components, just like, you know, anything else, like cars or airplanes. They use components from all over the world.
Sure.
These U.S.-built ships have, you know, foreign engines, you know, all kinds of foreign equipment, foreign propellers that make them work. So the U.S.-built ships that are wildly overpriced aren't even that American. Mm. So it's totally, you know, a trade war launched against our own citizens.
Crazy. Just
and you mentioned one other thing. You mentioned these Chinese owned ships. Well, of those 40,000 ships, something a lot of people don't realize is that Americans are some of the largest ship owners in the world. We own lots of ships. They just fly under flags of other countries. They're owned by Americans.
Of course they do. Hey, would you be able to give like an estimate on how many Americans run, like American citizens run ships that aren't covered under the Jones Act? Like, but are in?
I don't know, but I believe that
it's got to be more
by tonnage. I think the U.S. is like one of the top 5 biggest ship. American citizens are the like top 5 biggest ship owners in the world.
Jeez, wow.
Yeah, they just don't put them under the American flag. It's too expensive. Why would they? Too much regulation.
What are some popular countries?
Is there like a Delaware?
Yes, yeah.
Of of countries.
Yeah, so there are ships. They're called flags of convenience. These, you know, yeah. They basically, yeah, like you said, Navy is the equivalent of incorporated.
Can we take
Delaware.
A guess, Colin? Will you allow us to
Liberia,
take a guess?
Oh. Panama, the Marshall Islands are some of the top ones. You know, Singapore is another popular one. Malta, Gibraltar. Some of these are popular places to register your ship.
There you go.
Cool. I guess those countries are probably pretty pleased with the Jones Act.
I mean, the Maltese
world, you'd be able to, you know, use their ships to service American transportation needs, which they can't do, you know, at least domestically. They certainly service American transportation needs for importing, exporting. We
really need to get on the Maltese about this.
Yeah. Isn't Pete Buttigieg
yes.
he Maltese?
Yes.
Oh man. This is backdoor. They're keeping the boot on our throat with
Car, I told you. I told you.
Jones actors.
Car, I told you. He's the CIA guy.
Yeah, yeah. That's
and
right.
This is why.
Yeah.
Oh man. That is crazy. Well,
come together.
I'm glad we got an educational episode in. That was great, Carr.
Yeah,
this is a great one.
Yeah, we actually learned something new for once.
We did. Yeah, cool. Yeah, we did. Thank you, Colin. We really appreciate it. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
Educating us.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Hopefully,
talk Jones Act.
Hopefully, we'll get some of our listeners to start lightly haranguing their local Congress people. That would be great. Hey, guys. I mean, at the very least, you get to talk sternly to a Congressperson. Why not?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you try?
Sounds good.
Why wouldn't you try?
Yeah, and as Colin said, you know, feel free to kind of let it rip on the phone if you need to.
All right.
Open up those floodgates.
Colin, you know? why don't you steer us out of this one?
All right. Colin, well, before we do, Colin, you got anything you would like to plug?
Yeah, I'd just like to say, if you want to learn more about this, you can visit us at Cato's website at cato.org/JonesAct. And if you're active on Twitter, you can find me at CPGrabo, so CPGRABOW, and it's basically 100% anti-Jones Act content. You'll love it.
Oh, nice.
That's what the listeners crave.
Yes.
Yeah. Give people what they want.
I'm all in on this.
They don't know it.
This is one of those, like, hey, it's very clear what the problems are here. I'm in on it. I'm all in on anti-Jones Act. I'm 100%
me
in.
Me too.
Yeah, yeah,
me
yeah.
Too.
All right.
Well, I guess you can just go ahead and spread the word of the Friends Against Government podcast to all of our listeners, and until next week, keep two hands on the wheel.